MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And welcome back to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. We have a really special guest today, Aaron Brown, who spent 13 years in CIA operations, but his real thing these days is technology, the espionage technology, which has gone through a revolution thanks to AI and other techniques. And we'll be talking to him soon. But we just want to touch on some other weird things going on in our part of the world. Iran, what's going to happen there? Will he or won't he? We don't know yet. Venezuela, what's happening there? That's far from the front pages now. Greenland seems like ancient history. There are talks going on with Ukraine and Russia while the war plods on. These terrible air attacks on civilians in Ukraine is something we've just addressed in the Spy Talk newsletter today. But closer to home, we have the director of national intelligence interfering in election. What do we call this? Election review? Election witch hunt, coin a phrase?
Election security is how she refers to it.
Mike, take it away.
Yeah, well, look, a lot of people in our Spy Talk world were startled last week when Tulsi Gabbard, the DNI, showed up for the FBI search of Fulton County election records. Apparently, an effort to vindicate President Trump's insistence that he actually won the 2020 election,
which, good Lord.
Of course, he did not. But there was a lot of very strong reaction from Democrats on the Hill. Mark Warner, ranking Democrat on Senate Intelligence, James Himes, and others, demanding an explanation. Why was the Director of National Intelligence, who's supposed to be focusing on foreign threats, participating in a domestic law enforcement operation? And Gabbard actually wrote a pretty revealing letter back to them this week, maybe revealing a little more than she might have intended. But, you know, going through it, I just want to highlight a couple of points. First of all, she answered the question of why she was there. She said quite explicitly, my presence was requested by the president. So Trump told her to go down. Right. And it wasn't just her. We learned from this letter that she also brought along officers and analysts from something called the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, which is a unit within her office that focuses on counterintelligence. She also revealed that she had dual-hatted the Atlanta special agent in charge for the FBI as her domestic DNI representative, which means that the FBI agent in Atlanta reports to her as well as Kash Patel, the FBI director. Now, apparently this is a program that has existed for a while. I've never seen any public reference to it before, and certainly not in such a high-profile case.
Totally alarming.
This with political overtones. But the real, you know, question is, you know, The letter suggests all this was about election security and that there is foreign threats to the election, to our elections, that presumably tainted the 2020 vote in Fulton County, the most important county, most populous county in Georgia, and instrumental in swinging the state for Biden rather than Trump. But then
how ironic, because there was massive foreign interference in our elections in 2016 to help elect Trump.
Focused on dismissing and going after the people who revealed it. But then in the last letter, the last page of the letter, she points out that the search warrant, which was signed by a federal magistrate, was under seal. So then she writes, as such, I have not seen the warrant or the evidence of probable cause that the DOJ submitted to court for approval. So does she know the basis for this search or not? There she seems to be suggesting she actually doesn't. So what do we make of all this talk about, you know, foreign threats and counterintelligence? It's baffling, but it does reveal quite a bit.
Really? What does it reveal?
The degree to which DNI has immersed itself with the FBI beyond just Gabbert watching a search. She's cross-designating FBI agents to work for her. She's bringing counterintelligence officers down, participating in the search. That's revealing.
Okay. I think the country is being a little naive about where this has started and where this went. Because was the reason for creating DHS? The reason for creating DHS was to create after 9/11, counterterrorism agency, in addition to what we had at the FBI and our intelligence services. And what else happened?
To coordinate them all.
And what else happened in that period of time? We took down the alleged wall between intelligence and law enforcement, saying that we could now share information. And we may think that that was in the court setting, which is how it was usually described. It was in the collection setting and the sharing setting. Once you took down that wall, okay, a lot of civil liberties advocates were like, oh my God, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This is what they predicted. Almost from the time it was founded, DHS became the largest law enforcement agency in the country. That gave it tremendous amount of power without having the kinds of restraints that the FBI had, that the prosecutors in our federal court system had, etc. So in a way, this was sort of, and then if you just expand it because you have a president that is exploiting these loopholes that have existed before in this kind of vague who has responsibility for what and who gets to share what, it's not surprising to me that we've ended up here. And in terms of looking at the search warrant, I think the other, you know, line of it is not just I haven't seen it, but it doesn't matter what it says.
Right. Well, that I think that's the point.
Yeah. I mean, well, okay.
You know, this was a political exercise.
I think this is a very good topic for discussion for another podcast really soon about this intelligence. Well, it's a bit wonky on the legal,
you know me, I'm
side,
always the wonky one, but yeah, whatever.
But
yeah,
it's really important, and I think it's right in our jurisdiction. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit before we get to the interview. Let's talk a little bit about DHS using this facial recognition technology. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I suppose not surprising either, since, you know, intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies and others are using it, you know, left and right. So, of course, but it is.
Are we turning into China?
Given the tactics of ICE that have been revealed in Minneapolis most starkly, and the random way in which they're dragging people out of cars and outside their homes and all. And the many U.S. citizens who have been caught up in this mistakenly. Yeah, I mean, this is. I mean, I think we're going to have a discussion with Aaron Brown about in which he'll touch on authoritarian governments using facial recognition to clamp down on its citizens. I don't know what you'd describe our government right now, but given what ICE is doing, they certainly seem to fit the picture.
I hate to be so wonky about this. Are we turning into China? What's the difference between us and China on this issue of surveillance, privacy, and things like that? You know what the difference is? We have the Fourth Amendment. And then the question becomes, do we have the Fourth Amendment? And that's really,
yeah,
you know, when you're talking
used?
About,
yeah.
Yeah, are we respecting our laws? Not just the Fourth Amendment, but there are legal protections as well as constitutional protections. But really, the question is, which of the courts are going to support this? Is the Supreme Court ever going to do anything that would counter what this administration wants to do? And so de facto, are we turning into China? Perhaps. But in terms of where did our laws go? Have they just been pushed behind the curtain?
From what Mike said, I infer that, well, let's worry. This is an area of concern, but let's get ICE and the Border Patrol people to stop beating up people. You know, take
Good
off
point.
Their masks.
Good
stop,
point.
Stop busting into businesses
We're
and homes
identification.
Without a
We're
warrant.
Identification.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Tom Homan today did announce, this is Thursday, that they're going to draw down, 700, 800 ICE agents from Minneapolis. That seems to be a step in the right direction. Not, of course, what everybody wants, but it's a de-escalation move.
But that's a different question of when they are present, what powers are they using and how are they collecting information and what are they doing in terms of treating people on the streets? So they can pull out. But the real question is, how are they going to behave wherever they are?
Wherever they get resent.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, not a dull moment here. Okay, well, on to our interview with Aaron Brown, a CIA veteran, a former U.S. Army Ranger, even worked as a cop at one point. Between his time in the Army and going to CIA, well, he's become a leading expert on surveillance technologies. He founded a company called Lumbra, which is monitoring and I think developing, it's a little bit shadowy, what it's doing on the advanced technologies, including AI. He's going to talk to us about what's going on in that front. And after these messages, we'll bring him on.
Comfort is often the first thing we're willing to give up, like taking a long flight for a vacation or waking up early for a workout. But don't let style be the reason you aren't comfy. Mack Weldon's Ace Collection makes it effortless to look put together while feeling truly comfortable. Inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, the Ace Collection combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks. Upgrade your collection for the new year with bomber jackets, half zips, sweats, crew necks, and much more. Get comfortable anywhere with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
Aaron Brown, welcome to Spy Talk. You have quite the background. 13 years in clandestine operations at CIA. It ended, I think you were head of operations in Southeast Asia. You were an Army Ranger, toughest of the tough, I might say. and you did a transition from the Army Rangers to a police force in Wisconsin before joining the CIA. But to get to our point today, you were quoted in a lengthy piece by David Ignatius in the Washington Post last summer about innovations in espionage. That's right in the heart of our interests here. And what came clear to me, or apparent to me, was that the agency was way behind the curve on espionage technology. And one former senior operative described it as a sarcophagus of innovation. I mean, dead. So is that your understanding as well? And has the CIA caught up at all? Are they waking up to the innovations and the revolution in espionage technology?
Yeah, that article was fun for me to respond to after the fact. that sarcophagus comment being particularly interesting. So I'll help out my friend Ed Bogan there, who said that he meant sarcophagus in that you can't get the internet in there very easily. You can't get AI in there very easily, and so it's like living inside a sealed off container rather than dead. But most people took it as dead. So, but he, that was a little bit different. But what he was trying to imply is very much what I also believe, that it's really hard to get innovation into a place that has to try to ensure, you know, that they keep the secrets inside the place that, and they don't, you know, leak out. And the faster that technology moves, the more seamless information flows back and forth. And so it is not an easy task. That's for sure. I will say unequivocally, the agency is starting to catch up. And they were even catching up at the time of that article. And I think people were, many folks who hadn't been as close to the problem as I have, were still kind of responding to the agency of 2021, 2022. And now as the CIA is known to do, certainly during the Bin Laden era and some of the other great CT successes, once they get going and they recognize the problem and they come up with a plan to fix it, they get going very fast. And I think that's what I'm witnessing.
Let me ask overview question before. I know Mike and Karen have their own questions. We have seen generations of movies and we've read books about CIA tradecraft. It's very dramatized. You know, a guy trying to shake his surveillance and he changes his outfits and his look, even uses plastic face facial changes and so on. Is that all dead? I mean, is it possible? Is it impossible for, say, a CIA officer in Moscow or Beijing to get away from surveillance now? Or is it all so penetrating with the electronics that there's no hiding anymore? In fact, even hiding, as this article brought out, even hiding can draw attention. So is it all dead? Is dead drops, brush passes, et cetera, is that all dead?
I would say definitely not all dead. I will absolutely say much, much harder, incredibly more difficult. And you pointed out, I think one of the quotes that I gave is that the more that you attempt to hide now, the more that you stand out, because you know, the act of hiding itself creates a dead spot in data. And for most people in the world, you don't have dead spots in data. You're connected all the time, almost no matter what you're doing. But that the hazard then is, if you're connected, you're trackable. And so it's really a multifaceted, you know, 360 degree knife fight against digital surveillance. But going back to almost what I said before, the longer that the CIA gets to think about this, there's some extremely clever people who are starting to find space, which obviously, you know, because it's working, I obviously shouldn't talk about it here. And I don't even know about the best stuff that's working right now, but they're starting to get their hands around this problem. It does not look like it used to, for sure. You know, speaking not even in the classified domain right now, and like if you just go to credit card companies, banking, anything that requires, you know, authenticity, you know, authorization of use based on your identity, the commercial industry is crushing it, which is one of the problems. And facial recognition is powerful now, and you know, age verification starts to be able to determine, is that person wearing a mask? Is that person done something to their face that's artificial? And they now have systems in the commercial environment that can spot that. Whereas it used to just be human eyeballs that could spot that. There's some ATM machines that now you don't have to put your PIN in. You just walk up and your gait, the way your body moves, the geometry of your arm, your shoulder to your nose, is such a unique fingerprint that they don't even require your PIN because they're so confident of who you are based on your gait. That's not a fun space to be in if you're a spy.
So just to flesh this out a little bit, the lead example in the Ignatius piece, in which he was quoting you, is about facial recognition. And the issue is that the governments and intelligence agencies the CIA is spying on all have facial recognition that allows them to identify, make it more easy for them to identify the CIA spooks who are spying on them. And then you also raise the gait analysis, how you walk can tell you something. So how does the CIA, how does a Western intelligence agency thwart that?
I mean, I'd even zoom up beyond even just CIA officers. I think what's becoming really fascinating and interesting to me, and I think interesting also to the CIA, is that this is a privacy problem for literally any human. You know, the threat is different if you're trying to spy versus if you happen to be a Uyghur in China and you're a dissident and you're trying to stay off the China radar. In fact, the threat if you're a Uyghur is potentially death, and the threat if you're a CIA officer is probably just getting kicked out of the country. So it's the risks are not the same, but the technology that's being used against you is exactly the same. And so I think, you know, the ways that we get around this is I think starting to really understand how to use AI offensively. And so you see a bunch of really actually interesting technologists, mostly young people who are figuring out how to use this technology in ways that no one really imagined, to do a lot of adversarial techniques that I think are going to play out. I can't say for sure if the CIA are using them right now, but I would be surprised if they're not. To you know, so just to give you like one more quick example of like the more you hide, the more you stand out. It's not just a question of does the facial recognition recognize me as Aaron Brown and put together, you know, from the OPM hack or something that I'm a spy. It's that if it does, if it sees my face and doesn't recognize me as anyone that it has in its database, I'm suspicious. And so just drawing suspicion onto yourself in espionage becomes a critical thing, because now they have a reason to look at you. They don't know that you're a spy necessarily, but you've the eye of Sauron has sort of come onto you. And so you need to have ways to tell the system, this is not a spy and it's not suspicious.
And how do you do that?
So again, I'm gonna stay away from anything classified so I can preserve all the things I need to preserve to do my job. But I'll give you hypotheticals and like you. The best part is I don't know. I don't get to plug into this stuff as much anymore. So I can speculate. And if I get it close to right, I have to blame just my intuition that's being correct here. But if you think about a database, so if I wanted to trick a database into not recognizing me as a spy, but also not highlighting me as someone it's not supposed to see, maybe the database needs to have an injection that when it sees my face, it says that I'm business person A, B, C, D, E, F. I am not tripped up, flagged as a spy. And I'm also not flagged as suspicious. And so the more that AI allows for cyber operations to be much more effective and across larger swaths of the digital space, the more I think we can do things offensively to give ourselves an edge. We still own the AI space.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I remember the first time I went through a TSA airport security and there was facial recognition and I got kind of spooked. Now, of course, they immediately tell you, we're not going to keep this photo of you. I don't know whether you really believe them or not. And how about when you fly overseas and facial recognition when you go through airport security? So how, from a privacy perspective, you know, should we trust the TSA? And how about all those foreign airports? And if so, what does one do about it?
No, so I trust that the TSA agent that's telling you that it's not saved is telling the truth. And I trust that whoever
actually
was the programmer
pops up on the screen. They don't
That's right. I trust that the person who built the system, the entity that built the system, was given that as a requirement and that's what they're doing. But like if you're China and you know you have this system where anyone who's passing through to travel somewhere is delivering a unique identifier to them. You're trying to get access to that system such that you can, you know, at the point of facial recognition, can at least get the indication, you know, Aaron Brown was at the DCA airport at this time, at this date, going to this place. Individually, that's interesting, but in the aggregate, that's a real wealth of information about how is everybody moving around and what does it mean? That's the heartbeat, you know, of not only operations, but just what's the United States up to. If an entire mergers and acquisitions team that's working on the TikTok deal, for example, all travels to Texas and goes to Oracle, they all get on flights at the same time around the world and all end up in Austin or wherever Oracle exists. Then China has some commercial intelligence about what those people are doing. And the best way to know that will either be what are their cell phones up to or what are their travel records look like. And we know for a fact with Salt Typhoon, where China has deeply penetrated our telecommunications infrastructure, that they're definitely monitoring it that way. And so you have, and the OPM hack is such a great example, and it's so old now.
Well, let's explain that. Just take a second. The OPM hack.
Yeah. So Office of Personnel Management is the place in the United States government that keeps track of everyone's personnel files across the entire government. And they also know things like what your security clearance is, where your security clearance was issued. Many things can be told about a person based on the style of security clearance they have and where that security clearance was issued. And so when the Chinese
China stole it,
millions and millions of records. I'm in it. Lots of our colleagues are in it. And so they can just use that as a source of truth for here is Aaron Brown. What did he do in the government? And what's his personnel file look like? So incredibly debilitating from the perspective of secrecy, but a great indication of like what the Chinese specifically are capable of. The Russians are very capable in this regard too. And then non-state actors now armed with AI are becoming in some cases just as capable. You have to assume that your record is available at this point, right? There's no one that can assume I've escaped being disclosed in some kind of breach somewhere where the puzzle pieces come together and my whole person is exposed. It's just a given at this point.
I want to follow up on what you said about just, you know, Oracle, just to give an example. Because one of the things that's clear from the Ignatius article is the way in which a lot of the attempts to, you know, upgrade and modernize the CIA for things that it has noticed it's been lacking in for actually decades since George Tenet, right, has been carried by the private sector. And that the private sector, and you've gone from the intelligence world to the private sector world. And so I'm wondering how you think about this in terms of, it's not really outsourcing, it's sort of like insourcing. And it's you know, in 20 years ago, I can just hear the controversy over this, like, no, we're not going to let the private sector into this. And I'm curious how you assess the pros and cons and the risks associated with the way in which how deeply dependent the intelligence community seems to be intertwined with and dependent on the private sector, and how you think about that.
Yeah, you know, it's just a question of need. You know, speaking of the CIA, but not just the CIA. You know, when they were building spy satellites and incredible surveillance aircraft, and you know, little listening devices that were powered on, you know, the most impressive batteries anyone's ever seen. That was out of necessity because there was no one in the private sector that could build that. They needed it. They had enough scientific know-how to say, we think we can build it. There's no commercial market for it. And so we'll just build it. That has totally flipped now. And the technologies that are most powerful for the intelligence agencies are commercial technologies, AI being, I think, the most consequential of them. I think we are just now starting to glimpse what is going to be a monumental shift. I mean, there aren't synonyms glorious enough to qualify what I think is going to happen in the near term. And the challenge is that is just being developed in the private sector. You know, nobody in the government is going to put $100 billion into a training run for a model if there's no commercial interest, right? And so there are risks for sure, but I think the risk of not taking on commercial technology is much, much higher. It's the reason I transitioned out here. You know, I don't think everyone believes me when I say it, because I'm now a CEO of a company coming back in attempting to bring a product. But I think of myself as still a chief of base. You know, Lumbra is my company. I think of myself as chief of base of Lumbra. I just couldn't get myself out there under the government's guise. And so now I'm out here under my own. And that's what the best CIA officers have ever done, going all the way back to the OSS.
Aaron, we have to take a short break. Speaking of commercial interests, we'll be back in just a second. Okay, we're back. Aaron, Karen had a follow-up question.
Yeah, are there protections in place so that, and I'm not even talking about, you know, selling these secrets or these, you know, new applications to foreign entities, but, you know, what we've seen in the past is that sometimes private citizens, private groups can sometimes empower themselves to do things that the government should be doing. Is there any protections built in? And I'm sure there are, but what do they look like against this technology being used by private citizens for whatever reasons they want?
Sure. The protections for the private citizens using them is a little bit more challenging. You know, we probably would have to come up with a specific technology for me to think through an example. The protections I'm more concerned with as a citizen is these jumping the transom over to autocratic governments, because the ease of use now is just so simple.
Yes. And
I think we have a decent amount of protections built into our system here. The ITAR restrictions, where if you develop something in partnership with the U.S. government, you have to be very careful about how you potentially sell it to other governments, even you know, friends of the United States is difficult. And then export controls play a role here. We need to update those systems for sure, because you know, like right now it says you can't take your laptop to the foreign country if you're doing company work on the laptop. Well, most of us work in the cloud. The laptop is just a device to get to the cloud. Mm-hmm. And so like, that's kind of an outdated, you know, policy protection. So we have to definitely update these and think about what it means that digital boundaries don't exist the way that physical boundaries do. You know, everyday people, I think it's the same laws that we already have in place. They need to be updated, but, you know, I could track, you know, if given an opportunity and I wanted to sort of like, you know, become the neighborhood watch, you know, for my little neighborhood here in Virginia. And I got, ten of my neighbors to agree to like set up cameras that they gave me the feeds to. I guarantee you, we would never be robbed without a suspect in view. You might see that and be like, heck yeah, let's do that. That sounds great. But what comes along with that is that then Aaron Brown, you know, neighbor at such and such street and address, now knows the comings and goings of everybody all the time. And do you really want me to know that? You might think you do right now, but you probably don't.
Yesterday, I went to a lecture by Nick F. Demiades, who we've had on the podcast before. He's an expert on Chinese espionage, and he drew quite a an alarming picture of China's success in penetrating American commercial entities, especially in the aerospace and technology field. So what can you tell us, if anything, about China's ability to steal? Maybe they don't even need to steal it from us at this point.
That's just it.
What have they penetrated our intelligence technology companies so they can steal this technology and use it against us?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just saw in the last couple of days another arrest out of Google, which is a perfect example. It's not even the most recent one.
But that didn't take any special technology. That guy just defected to China. It took all of Google's engineering expertise with him. Old-fashioned, old-timey stuff.
And the guy before him was a guy named Ding Luwei, did something very similar for a lot of their AI TPU technology, their version of the GPU that so many folks are probably familiar with. And you're exactly right. A lot of this doesn't involve tradecraft, doesn't involve any of the old school techniques. It's just straight up commercial espionage. And the problem is that so much of what used to be needed to be protected were systems, just going back to what Karen mentioned, systems that were built inside the government. And so we built up protections for those in order to ensure that they couldn't be stolen, or if they were going to be stolen, they were going to be stolen through espionage techniques. Commercial companies do not have systems for this protection. And they're in the opposite position. And this is where, like, you know, American kids and many of the folks in non-autocratic countries need to, like, go study math to a much larger degree and engineering. Because the Chinese are kicking our butts here. And so when a Google needs someone who's an expert in you know, some really obscure amount of engineering that's required for AI, it is often a Chinese national who has to be employed to even make that progress. And again, the individual people, when you meet them, are going to be amazing people. Some of them are doing more good work for America than Americans themselves. But the second that their grandfather's chemo is turned off in Shenzhen, and they're told, we'll turn it back on only if you bring us the model weights for this AI lab. They don't view it as doing anything wrong necessarily, other than, you know, violating their employment agreement. But come on, they're not spying.
Of course they are.
It makes it real tough. Well, they are, but I mean, in their mind, they're repatriating technology for their home country. Right?
Yeah, we don't have that ability to do. I mean, we don't have Americans working for Chinese companies in that kind of sector where we can flip the game.
That's exactly right.
But Aaron, it's not just the commercial firms that have been penetrated. I mean, the CIA itself, we know that in China, they rolled up a whole bunch of undercover, you know, covert operatives in China, and also, I believe, in Iran. So isn't that exactly an example of the threat that you're talking about here, that using high tech to penetrate even secure systems,
operations? Yeah, so one's a counterintelligence risk, the other is just the standard espionage risk. And I think, you know,
tell us what you can about what the Chinese did. I mean, that's been
so I'm much less familiar with that one than the Iranian one. But mm-hmm. I mean, again, I just speculating. Whereas the you know, what we know from what's been released in the press with regard to the Chinese, they have the most amazing integrated surveillance system on the planet. And they have tested it on their own people. They have refined it. It wasn't built to catch spies, right? They didn't think, wow, you know, if we built this, we could just catch all the espionage going on. No, they built it to control their own population and to, you know, tamp down on dissent. It just so happens that the benefit of it happens to be, well, if you can do that, you can catch everyone else doing anything wrong as well. And so it just becomes so, when you have, I forget what the numbers are, I used to know them right off the top, I had 100 million CCT cameras or something like that, or it might even be a billion at this point. When you have a camera that's effectively facing all areas of public space and you have a suspicion about something, well, you can rewind the tape. And when you have a workforce that is orders of magnitude more than anyone else has available to them in both the military and national security spaces, you have the people available to rewind the tape and actually really work to figure out what's going on. And now they have the AI to do it agentically, which is a whole nother arena that we haven't even seen play out in real time yet.
We've talked about us and China. What about the Russians or other adversaries? Are they up to snuff at all? Are they competitive in this realm?
the Russians are, you know, what we're seeing from the Chinese government is a real amazing ability to execute a strategy at huge scale. The Russians are just much better at tactics, right? Their strategy and what they do, but their individual successes often look tactical. And so, you know, their cyber groups are usually not focused on some kind of grand plan, whereas I think China's are. Their cyber groups are usually looking at some kind of disruption that will have a tactical advantage for Russia in some way, right? This is the crazy bear, fancy bear, attacks that are, you know, designed to say, hey, can we shut down the gas pipelines in the United States? Is there a real goal, something strategic there? I think not. I think they just want to say, if we needed to wreak havoc for a moment in time, do we have that ability? Yes, we do. Whereas the Chinese think, what if we penetrated all the places that we could get all the data such that when we added all the ones and zeros together, we knew all the things? Totally different approach. Equally capable to the degree of getting into the systems, but just with different designs on the plan.
Hey, Aaron, I have a question about what this means for, I have a couple of questions following up on that. One is, what does this mean for human intelligence? You know, we're talking about the tech world and, you know, data collection and data analysis, et cetera, et cetera. But what about human beings as spies? And one of the things that, you know, with all of this ability to, you know, look at one's gait, connect it with one's facial recognition, et cetera, et cetera, is it over that we can't use human spies? Are there new programs being developed to rethink how to do this? I mean, where does this now stand in terms of trust and confidence of intelligence professionals?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll maybe work backwards and say, I think you can take it to the bank that as long as the CIA is in existence, there will always be new programs for doing the second oldest profession. Okay. And so that one's all, I don't think that will change anytime soon. And then getting to the first part, it may make the numbers of what you can do smaller, right? Because it's just the more, you know, people you put on the space, the more data you're creating and then the more, you know, dots you allow to be connected. And so, but I think espionage is, especially in the era of deep fakes and voice clones, like how can you ever be sure if you want to be an agent and you know, give some critical piece of information to a foreign power that you think they need to have for whatever your purpose is, and you get on the phone or a Skype call or a Google Signal. Meets call or, you know, but yeah, or Signal, whatever. And, you know, before you'd have to be like, well, if the Chinese were going to call me, they have to like find someone who speaks unaccented English, idiomatic, that understands American culture, to be able to at least convince me that I'm talking to an American. No more. You could spin up 1,000, 10,000 American sounding, perfect idiomatic English that are going to know exactly the tradecraft of any espionage service to place that signal call. And so what you're and the same thing for a video is coming as fast, if not already here, as the audio. And so then what that's going to then, I think, revert back to is the only thing you're going to trust as a human in person. If you really, really want to be sure. And so I can't see how that won't persist.
So you realize you're under constant surveillance and many dimensions of surveillance. So you have to have personal meetings in some way. But how do you have these personal meetings if you're under this constant surveillance?
You
cannot enter a country anymore. You know, with all the biometric screening that goes on in airports, you can't fly into, say, Saudi Arabia, go to your hotel, change your passport, change your clothing, et cetera, and move on to the next place to meet an agent. That's over, right?
So I this is where I have to hope that I disappoint the three of you, that you get off the call with me and you're like, gosh, that guy was a hard nut to crack on some of these tough questions. Cause that's the role I think I have to play here if I'm going to be allowed to be part of the solution. But this is where again, I'll go back to without again, breaking any news, and say, this is where we have the advantage technologically in the United States. Like the most sophisticated AI, the most sophisticated systems right now are still being built, in this country. By Americans. And it looks like we have that edge for some time to come. We have to preserve it. So when we think about what edge do we have to make sure we ensure, and this is where like, should we be selling GPUs to China? I think that's a tricky question to answer. I kind of can see both sides, but I think I come down on, I think we should give them no advantage at this point because we need to maintain this edge. I think if we can maintain this edge there are so many more tools in our tool belt right now for subterfuge than there ever were before. And so I think what we're going to see is we're going to have to become, just as we were with masks and tradecraft techniques for surveillance back in the day and sort of the, you know, the analog era, we're now going to have to become that good at using technology to create the space to do those operations. And I'll tell you right now, they don't involve me in those things right now. But if we did, those would be the things where like I would be just as offended at myself as anyone else if they start talking about that, because the second that becomes public, it no longer works, and that puts a lot of things at risk. But I think we can take to the bank that they're on the path towards real solutions in this space.
So we have more tools for subterfuge than ever before. That kind of takes us a full circle. And I have to bring up something else, and I know it's on Mike's mind as well. DHS, Border Patrol, ICE, they're starting to use facial recognition technology here. Do you worry about this technology being in bad hands in this administration?
So I'm a please don't track me kind of person to my core, right? And so this is a weird space that people like practitioners like me are in, and that the more that we have things to track with, the more effective we are at our job. But the more that we have things to track with means other people have things to track us with, and that feels bad to me. And so I'm in a constant quarrel with myself about being excited about a technology that allows me to do something spectacular with AI that you know makes intelligence way easier. At the same time, I'm like, wow, now this can be used against me and my family and all that. And that doesn't seem like a great idea. And so, facial recognition and just digital surveillance itself, now, especially with agentic AI coming into the field and coming into its own right now, just makes tracking infinitely easier. And it makes me so nervous, even in the hands of a well-meaning government. I recognizing your time, I'll give you one example of which I think we're unfortunately going to get to see in our lifetimes. We're going to see AI models, and go to Dario Amodi's last essay on this in the last 2 weeks or so. He writes very good essays on what's coming. And we're going to see AI that's going to be capable of designing a biological weapon that could have massive effects. And what we're going to find is that people who had the motivation to do that for the longest time, this goes back to the realm of terrorism too. People constantly ask me, why aren't terrorists more effective? And I said, fortunately, the people who become terrorists often are extraordinarily inept at planning. And so we have to be lucky. They're motivated to be a terrorist, but they have no idea how to form a plan and then carry it out. That's one of the only reasons. Same thing for someone who wants to, you know, kill a million people with a biological weapon. Fortunately, they often don't have a PhD in biology, but they don't need it anymore because they have a PhD in their pocket. And so if they have the motivation, they might now have the know-how. So here's where surveillance becomes really tricky. If I tell you that now we have that, and the only way to stop that is if we deploy an extraordinarily effective surveillance system that I will guarantee you will spot anyone who ever tries to bring one of these biological weapons into existence, will you say no to that? If I tell you it's absolutely coming, I think most of us are going to say we're going to consider it, and most of us are going to say yes.
Okay, can I just want to bring back the human element here for one second, which is that given everything you're saying, what I think a lot of people have the question of, you say you know all of this because of the data collection and analysis, but who's doing the analysis? Is the machines that are doing the analysis? And how, I'm assuming that you just trust that this kind of analytics, you, not just you, but, you know, larger group of, that it seems to me that there's an awful lot of just plain technology knows how to do it, when I know that individuals in the intelligence field really pride themselves on their own analytical interpretation. So where does the human begin and the technological end, and how do they mix?
Shifting target literally by the hour. Right now. But I will say to you that more and more of these systems are explainable. They are interpretable. And so when you have a system that's really good at looking at huge swaths of data, so what I say about agentic AI now that I think helps people sort of visualize what happens here, they're extraordinarily good at hard to generate data problems. And so if you have a huge set of data, one of the examples we show is all the time is looking at an image anywhere in the world, and one of those images that could be in Australia, it could be in Florida, it could be in Malaysia. In the case example I use is actually Tel Aviv, which kind of looks like Southeast Asia in some places, and other places it looks like Greece, right? And I have people try to guess it. No one ever guesses Tel Aviv because it looks so much like some other place. That is a hard to generate thing because it could be any one of a million or a billion places in the world. AI guesses it instantly, knows exactly where it is every single time. It says, this is Tel Aviv on the corner, blah, blah, blah. The cool part about that is once you know where it is, going back and validating that that's correct is a 2-second problem. It's an infinite problem for humans to figure out where it is, but it's a 2-second problem to validate. And so the same thing happens here. The analysis that AI does is looks across billions and billions of data points and says, here's one of the answers that you're looking for. Here's 10 answers. Now you can go back and say, do I think those answers are right? And the story of how AI got there is now tellable. And that's how analysis, what that allows is analysts to use their time to do logic problems rather than discovery, which was, you know, 80% of their task up until now.
So, Aaron, you were a counterterrorism officer when you were in CIA. We actually did a podcast last week on the current state of the counterterrorism threat. We had Colin Clark from the Soufan Center on talking, and he said a couple of things that are, I think are relevant to this discussion. One of the things we talked about, of course, was the Islamic State in Khorasan. You were saying before that the terrorists are pretty bad at planning, but sometimes they do succeed, and Islamic State has pulled off some pretty spectacular operations in recent years in Moscow and Iran and elsewhere. But one of the points that we drill down is they're using AI right now. The Islamic State Khorasan, after their the Crocus Music Hall attack in a couple of years ago, was use AI to create fake news anchors to broadcast and propagandize about the attack that they just pulled off. So the bad guys, you know, are working on the with the same technology we are. My first question is how concerning should that be?
Concerning. This is similar to the biological. There's overlap here. Obviously, Bin Laden spent a lot of time trying to determine if he could produce a biological weapon that would have a greater effect than, you know, humans flying airplanes. And I should be careful. Obviously, from time to time, fortunately, it's only from time to time. Not only are they capable of planning, they're capable of carrying out spectacular attacks. And 9/11 stands out as the one that's most notable. But for the most part, you know, they're like one out of 10,000 or something that they plan and bring to fruition. So my worry is AI has the potential to really up that ratio because you go from, you know, you just remember back from some of the 9/11 planners, the research they were doing about how they were supposed to dress and should they wear cologne and these, you know, these questions that they were just getting wrong left and right. Well, now you ask ChatGPT and you have the exact right answer on those all the time. Those are trivial ones, obviously, but like when you can stack right answers on top of right answers, you get much more likely to get further along in your plan. And I think that is concerning because it's really hard to stop that. You can't use ChatGPT right now to plot a terrorist plan from, you know, A to Z, thankfully. But you can certainly go from A to B, B to C, C to D, as long as you're not connecting it together as a terrorism plot. And I think they get that. And
The other point he made, and I'd like to get your thoughts on, is especially after the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan in 2021, we lost our presence there. And that meant we also lost any ability for human on what these terrorist groups, particularly the Islamic State, is up to. And, you know, he suggested that while our signals intelligence is still good, the human, particularly on these, you know, really nasty terrorist groups, is virtually non-existent at this point.
There's no replacement for proximity. Face-to-face meeting. I've met a lot of
bad guys.
Bad guy. I hesitate because they weren't all terrorists, right? A lot of them were terrorist adjacent. Arabic was my language du jour. I don't even know if du jour is right there. It's just to prove the point that it was Arabic.
not French.
It's no French. I think there's just no question when you can have the proximity and the frequency of engagements and human engagements, it's a game changer, as we saw. We dismantled Al Qaeda from 2009 to 2012, and the engagements there on the ground were instrumental in that. Obviously, the Bin Laden piece was very much technology driven and not necessarily driven by humans, but all that allowed that to be possible was human focused and proximity focused.
Well, I think there could be a good movie made based on a guy like you who invents all this incredibly sophisticated and deceptive technology, and it comes back to bite him. So
I wrote a screenplay. I'm going to send it to David Ignatius, actually. He encouraged me. I said, I have some ideas. And he's like, I think you should write some of these down and send them to Netflix. So I'll send it your guys' way, too. You can let me know if I'm on the right track.
I'll look forward to that movie. We have to wrap it up now. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Aaron. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
It's great. You guys kept me on my toes. This is the most I've been on my toes yet in one of these. So good job. Thank you.
It was pretty scary, actually. A lot of this stuff.
The optimism is there. We didn't get to close with the optimism, but the optimism is great. Like, we're going to cure cancer. We're going to do a lot of things with biology and aging that would have been impossible even 18 months ago. And I'm optimistic that those are going to be, that's the way we're going to go. It's just, we got to get there carefully.
Well, good for you. I'm not that optimistic. Anyway, thanks for coming on the Spy Talk podcast. It was really fun.
Thank Bye-bye. You very much.
Thanks,
have a good day.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.